Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Happy Wednesday morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up this hour, a humanitarian aid worker is going to face another trial, and we'll talk about a federal lawsuit that aims to blame the government for exacerbating climate change.
But first, after a video of Phoenix police officers with their weapons drawn on a family with young children was released, city leadership has had several meetings to look at police policy. Tuesday evening, city council members and dozens of residents discussed a civilian police review board, among other things. It was a marathon meeting that KJZZ reporter Casey Kuhn attended, and she joins us now. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning.
So this meeting was unique in many ways, not least the setting at the Orpheum Theater. So tell us where the meeting was, what was this all about?
Right. So the six-hour-long meeting took place, like you said, in the beautiful Orpheum Theater because of a power outage at the council chambers. So more impressive than the theater, though, was really the fortitude of all the people who came out to wait and speak about how they felt on all of the police policies that were being discussed. Mayor Kate Gallego says this is all to take input from the community, like I said, which there was a lot of.
We need to understand there are people who feel that police are not their allies, and still others who feel that police are being treated unfairly, and still many others who fall somewhere in the middle.
And it was clear, like I said, from how many people spoke, probably about 50 or so, that there were a lot of people with a lot of ideas on what needs fixing, and it sounded like nobody really thought that the city was doing things right.
So there was criticism on both sides, it sounds like. What did the council actually do yesterday, and what does it mean for this whole story?
So this meeting ended up being about two things. One was the long discourse on whether to keep moving forward in the plan to start a civilian review board of the police. But I thought we would hear more about the actual action items that city council voted on. They voted to start looking for both an early intervention system, and that tracks and checks officer behavioral data. They also voted to start looking for a firm to do a public opinion survey on the police in the community. And the last time Phoenix did something like that was in 2012, but it wasn't just about police. So Police Chief Jerry Williams was there. She said it's not just the public she needs to hear from, but her own employees.
Within the last 2 weeks, we held six employee sessions in six locations, and hearing my employees hear my expectations of them and then provide them the space and the time to share some of their information as well was one of the most beneficial things that I've done in the almost 2 years that I've been here.
And so I thought that was kind of an interesting bit of information that got lost in a lot of the accusations flying back and forth during the discussion part of the meeting.
Okay, so action items, like you mentioned, weren't voted on unanimously. Who voted against the next offhand survey, and why?
Okay, so there was that one no vote, and on both items it came from Vice Mayor Jim Waring. He certainly had a lot to say, kind of about everything during the meeting. And on these two topics, his biggest criticism was that the technology would be, one, redundant, and two, a waste of taxpayer money. He was not the only one to express those concerns. And the main issue he seemed to have was that there are already record management systems that can be managed by hand in the police department. But this new software could be a tool to put all of that information together. And the survey, he said, could end up showing disparate ideas across the valley. So here's Waring.
And we just keep adding more to the pile, and this polling falls in that category, even if it turns out to be in their favor. I appreciate you hearing me out. I don't think I can support this, but I understand the reason you're planning to do it. I just don't know if it's going to accomplish the goals that I think you're hoping that it will.
And actually, there was also public comment from both sides of the debate that agreed with him on that.
Okay, so what's next?
Okay, there's a formal city council meeting today at 10 this morning. It's the last formal council meeting before break. And as for the other items, they voted to start compiling a list of places they may eventually get both the software and the public opinion firm from. Mayor Kate Gallego said in regards to the civilian board, a September work study session will happen to get more details on how to implement it and what it would look like. Last night, we just heard the overview, and there are still a lot of steps to actually getting a review board in place.
All right, that's KJZZ's Casey Kuhn. Casey, thanks.
My pleasure.
So after that lengthy meeting, the Phoenix City Council will not officially be forming, at least not yet, a civilian oversight board to review actions by police officers. Many other cities, large and small, do have those kinds of boards, which fall into three categories: investigation-focused, review-focused, and an auditor-monitor model. Liana Perez used to be the independent police auditor for the city of Tucson. She's currently director of operations for the National Association for Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement, and she's with me. Liana, I mentioned those three oversight models. Can you explain each of those and how they're different?
So the auditor model is usually an oversight entity that actually has the authority to go in and not only audit, you know, citizen complaints, but also audit policies and procedures within a police, you know, agency, but they don't have any investigative authority, so they're usually reviewing things after the fact. A review model is usually what some of the boards, the citizen boards, also come under, and they are also reviewing after the fact with respect to citizen complaints of police misconduct. So they're usually reviewing the work of Internal Affairs or Office of Professional Standards, whatever they call themselves within those police agencies that are doing investigations of citizen complaints. The investigative model is the one that's a little more robust and obviously needs more resources. And those models are the ones that actually have full investigative authority. They are the ones conducting the investigations themselves. So an investigator model has a staff of investigators, and they can issue findings and make recommendations as well.
How resource intensive is this kind of independent oversight? I guess I'm wondering, in order to be effective, does there have to be a real investment of money and resources for this kind of a group?
There does. I mean, and it depends on what the city is willing to invest. Normally, the investigative model is obviously the most expensive because you need a full complement of investigators and everything that goes with it, you know, resources, access to databases, some have subpoena power. Those are pretty resource intensive and pretty expensive. Usually New York City, San Francisco, some of those larger cities have full investigative models. The most successful ones seem to be the ones that have at least some paid professional staff to be the liaison on a day-to-day basis, because the volunteers don't have an actual, you know, established location, an office, a building or anything like that where citizens could go to, you know, on a daily basis. If, you know, if they're volunteers, they're usually only meeting, you know, once a month or every 2 weeks or sporadically. And so it's not a constant source or resource for, you know, the community to access.
What degree of tension is there? And can that eventually be smoothed out? Or is that just a natural tension that is going to exist?
It goes in kind of waves, so to speak. It is a natural tendency. It's obviously the tension is probably higher right at the beginning, because here again, from the police, you know, department's perspective or union, it's an unknown, not knowing, number one, who, you know, what the level of authority is going to be. You know, the pushback is usually that, you know, they don't want somebody outside of the department, you know, making findings or making recommendations for discipline. You know, the tension from the community's perspective is, you know, what is it you don't want us to see? Or, you know, what should we, you know, what kind of questions should we be asking and what information are we not getting? And then, you know, from, you know, the elected officials, I mean, there's that tension where, you know, on one hand, you know, your police department is serving a tremendous purpose in your communities, you know, law enforcement, public safety, but you're, you know, you want your community to trust your law enforcement agency, because that level of trust needs to exist in order for the police department to also do their job. When I say it goes in waves, it can, you know, as time goes on, once everybody is in a position to recognize what their level of authority is and their roles in the process, things seem to smooth out a little bit. Not to say that the tension doesn't go up and down based on, you know, either, you know, high profile events or recommendations that are made. I mean, there's always going to be that pushback, but, you know, if professional working relationships are established between the various stakeholders, that's a good way to alleviate some of that tension.
Does it make sense to you that every community or most communities would have some sort of civilian review board, and that can vary
what a city needs from time to time. But does it make sense that that's more of that community connection that's needed? Or, again, does it come down to whether a situation warrants it?
I think it makes sense, especially in the larger communities, to have one in place, because it's not usually a matter of, you know, when, you know, if something happens, it's going to happen. and you don't want to be creating an oversight entity in a very reactionary manner with respect to, oh, we need this, this, and this because this just happened. It's good to kind of put some thought into it. And again, you know, going back to the stakeholder groups, to get what is best for the community. Now, I give this kind of advice on a daily basis when I talk to people from different parts of the country. I suggest to them that, you know, no two entities are identical oversight entities. They may be called an auditor, they may be called a monitor, they may be called a review or investigative model, but they all have different levels of authority and responsibility. So they are created with, you know, the needs of the community also in mind.
All right, that is Liana Perez. She is Director of Operations for the National Association for Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement. Liana, thanks very much for the conversation.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration's announcement that it will retry a humanitarian aid worker in southern Arizona came just as a report was published about the targeting of aid workers, attorneys, and journalists along the U.S.-Mexico border. And here to discuss this with me more is Michelle Morisco from our Fronteras desk in Tucson. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning.
So the report is called Saving Lives is Not a Crime, and it focuses on targeted legal harassment of people at the border. What are the allegations?
The report was put up by Amnesty International. They said that journalists and activists and, for example, immigration lawyers for asylum seekers were all put on sort of these surveillance watch lists. They said that these people were being watched, that there were dossiers created monitoring where these folks are working on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. And there's a slew of targeted misdemeanor cases against No More Death, which you and I have discussed in the past. This all kind of came up against the same theater, the same backdrop, almost an organized or at least a systemic pattern of that level of harassment and then these arrests.
So Scott Warren, the humanitarian aid worker in question here, I know has a chance to plea down this case. Any chance he'll take it?
I don't think so. Yesterday he read prepared remarks from a cell phone, so he had at least one answer for if the government was going to try to go after him again. It sounded like he and his attorneys are prepared to go to trial again. One interesting element in all this is, you know, now the U.S. government knows exactly what sort of defense they will mount to support and bolster his case that he was not smuggling, that he was only out there helping people. It'll be interesting to see if the U.S. tries a different tack, if indeed this goes to trial.
So where does this end, Michelle? I mean, is the U.S. government trying to do away with No More Death groups like this completely?
You know, during the closing arguments, it's a great question. Last trial, Prosecutor Anna Wright, U.S. Attorney's Office, Arizona, said that No More Deaths was trying to stymie the Border Patrol at, quote, every turn. And before that, they had said humanitarian aid is not on trial. So they're making two arguments here, right? They're sort of saying No More Deaths is not a true humanitarian aid group. They did start off as an activist group in 2004. And there's been this, again, the systemic targeting of No More Deaths activists along the border here. It's certainly looking like the U.S. government is trying to target the aid group, and will be interesting to see if more arrests persist after this.
All right. That's Michelle Morisco with our Fronteras desk in Tucson. Michelle, thank you for keeping us up to date on this.
Hey, thank you.
The barrage of negative headlines concerning police nationwide is causing college students to reconsider careers in law enforcement. That's the finding of a new study published in the Journal of Criminal Justice Education. The tipping point occurred almost 5 years ago in a city outside St. Louis.
Hands up!
Don't shoot!
Hands up!
Don't shoot!
The St. Louis suburb of Ferguson is reeling today.
Riots, vandalism, looting, and fires overnight.
Well, we really are afraid for our young boys' lives.
All this after a police officer shot and killed an unarmed teenager.
This has to stop. It has to stop.
The shooting death of Michael Brown helped trigger the Black Lives Matters movement, which raised awareness of the deaths of African Americans by mostly white police officers. Weston Morrow, a criminal justice professor at the University of Nevada, Reno, is the author of the new study. He says the backlash against police led to what some have called the Ferguson effect.
This idea that this negative attention of police and accusations of racial profiling and or excessive force was really discouraging law enforcement from their policing duties. And subsequently, right, this is leading to increases in crime.
While some cities have seen increases in crime, Morrow says criminologists around the country examined the so-called Ferguson effect and pretty much came up empty.
To date, what the research has found is that, you know, we're not experiencing a national crime wave in the United States. You know, this quote unquote war on cops is not at a rate that is, you know, higher than any previous decade. And then the other one about depolicing, there is some evidence to suggest that certain states have engaged in depolicing. Say, for instance, they're not stopping as many individuals, traffic stops, but it's not necessarily translating into increases in crime for that state.
So Morrow and some colleagues decided to look at one impact that hadn't been investigated.
Instead of looking at the effect on crime rates, they turned their attention to prospective police officers, college students. Researchers surveyed 460 students enrolled in criminal justice classes at a university in the Southwest and one in the Northeast. What they found was surprising.
Students who have viewed police officers as being more heavily scrutinized by the public and the media were less likely to apply for police positions or more hesitant to apply for police positions, which is, you know, potentially problematic because there's a lot of benefits associated with having a college education or being more educated and being a police officer.
And that could have serious consequences.
That's because police departments here in Arizona and nationwide can't find enough new recruits. The Center for State and Local Government Excellence reports that the hardest job to fill of any category of personnel is that of police officer.
So what can be done to counter this? Morrow says police need to do a better job communicating with the community they serve.
There needs to be a concerted effort on their behalf to reach out to community members and, you know, especially those at college and try and, you know, kind of provide that counterweight to what they see in the media.
So now let's put a face to this phenomenon.
Brett Matthews is wrapping up his criminology and criminal justice degree at ASU Online. He lives in Sacramento and from a young age wanted to protect and serve.
So I actually wanted to go into law enforcement and start as a police officer to begin with and eventually work my way up into working at the federal level. And this was a dream of mine probably since I was in elementary school or junior high. So it's pretty much been like a lifelong goal.
So that's why you went into criminology when you went to ASU and chose that path?
Yeah.
Tell me about the experience of going into school for criminology and what you learned and what you liked about it.
So what criminology is so great about doing is it touches on, you know, sociological aspects, psychological aspects, you know, legal reasons and definitions for why people may or may not commit crime. And as someone who's kind of an analyst myself, it was absolutely fascinating, still is fascinating as I'm completing my last course, all the different theories out there that might kind of define why a particular crime might happen, because I'm the kind of person that likes to get down to the basic element of why did this occur?
So I understand, though, that you've changed your mind recently, that you're no longer interested in that particular path and going into law enforcement. What happened?
So that is a pretty big question. And there were a few things that happened. One of the things that ended up happening was I did become a parent and I had to consider, you know, roles and jobs that I would go into as a single father and what could potentially put me in harm's way or not in harm's way for my son and wanting to be there. And to go along with that, what really caused me to think about that even more, I experienced a lot of backlash and negativity from my surrounding community, from those people who knew that I was interested in pursuing a career in law enforcement.
What did people say?
So when I would want to go study and, you know, get away from, you know, some of the parenting responsibilities and go do my coursework, I'd either go to like a Starbucks or a library, and people would see, you know, my books out and they'd be curious and have questions. And probably 65-70% of the time, people would start off with, so you just want to be aggressive and have a badge to defend that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would get into conversations with people and say, you know, this actively is not anywhere near the stigma that I've got towards police officers or the work. I want to do this to help my community.
When was the moment when you decided you weren't going to do it anymore? Like, was there something specific that happened, or what kind of tilted the scales in that direction for you?
So while I have been a student, I've also done some, you know, on the side Lyft and Uber driving. And there was one particular family that got in, and they were a African-American family, and they happened to notice, you know, my books, and in the app it said I was a student, you know, for criminology. And they're like, oh, so you really just don't care about the people. And then they started talking about how they had family members killed by, you know, people who were of Caucasian descent who were in uniform, and the negativity that many members of the African American community associate with Caucasian members in uniform.
Yeah.
And I just kind of sat there and thought about it. I was like, wow, is this the predominant thought that many members of this minority community have and feel? And if that's the case, am I really doing my community a service by going into uniform? Maybe I'm not. If they're going to perceive me in such a way, regardless of my intent, maybe this isn't the right path.
Do you understand where those reactions are coming from those people, or were you offended?
Oh, I was absolutely offended, you know, because these are people who were making a judgment about me based on the color of my own skin without knowing who I am, without knowing what my background is or what my intent was. But they seem to have really deep-seated beliefs. It seems like there's a lot of things that have been going on in the media from minority organizations or groups like Black Lives Matter that have really, you know, shown like, hey, cops are not people to actually be trusted.
Do you feel like there's something to that? Do you feel like you could have, as a police officer, tried to counter those points of view, even though there have been instances in which that has happened? There have been, you know, white officers who have killed people of color, and the communities have felt like they have not been held accountable for that.
You know, I like to think there's a possibility that I could have helped change some of those minds. But as I think about it more from a community-oriented policing approach, honestly, I think members of those communities or you know, people who come from representations of the minority population might in some ways be able to do a better job than I could, because I don't understand where these people are coming from. Hmm. You know, I can have sympathy and sympathize for them and some of their issues and situations, but I can't fully empathize like a minority or, you know, a police officer with a minority background or descent would be able to do it in the same way. I feel like I would really struggle with establishing that level of trust that so many of the minority population just don't have.
What are you planning to do now, Brett, now that you're not on this law enforcement track?
I am actually transitioning into more of a emergency management type of setting and role. And that will be actually what I'll be focusing on in my advanced degree settings that I'll be pursuing at ASU in the fall.
All right. Brett Matthews, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brett Matthews is a criminology student at ASU who will be graduating soon. This is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger along with Steve Goldstein. Still to come this hour, could lack of sleep lead to heart problems? We'll talk about new research on that. And stay tuned at 10 o'clock for the takeaway.
The fireworks that light up Arizona's sky tomorrow night also create a health hazard for people with breathing problems. Just ask Valley residents who had health issues this past New Year's Eve when smoke from fireworks caused the valley to exceed federal air quality standards. Joining me now to talk about the impact of fireworks on air quality is Matt Pace, meteorologist for the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. Matt, how at risk are we for air quality issues on the 4th of July, related or not to fireworks? And have we exceeded our quality standards previously on the 4th?
So typically on the 4th of July, we have pretty strong heating during the day. So we don't see those 2.5 issues at all during the day, but we do see a slight rise in PM 2.5 around the valley, especially between about that 8 and 11 o'clock hour. It doesn't often exceed the federal health standard. In fact, that only happened once in our records from 2010 to 2018. And that happened in 2014 when we did actually exceed the PM 2.5 standard.
So are there any conditions we're looking at for Thursday that might give us a chance of reaching that again?
So it is unlikely that we will exceed the standard this particular holiday. We have some winds that'll move through and kind of move that pollution off towards the north and the northeast. But certainly we still are expecting a jump in 2.5 between that 8 and 11 o'clock hour.
So let's compare seasonally, because the two times of year really where we see sorts of fireworks around here, one is around New Year's Eve and then 4th of July. Obviously, our weather patterns very, very different at that point. For those with breathing issues or pollution issues, how would you compare those different points of the year?
Certainly, they're completely different, especially during the New Year's holiday when we typically do see some exceedances from all the firework smoke and also the residential burning is basically the time period that we're looking at. On New Year's, typically everyone's lighting off their fireworks right in that same time period, right before we strike midnight and then just after. So you have a big volume of smoke that goes up into the atmosphere. And also during that time, we're a lot cooler. So that inversion that kind of traps that pollution down here in the valley is a lot lower. So you can't really mix that into the atmosphere very well, where during the July 4th time, obviously, we're a little warmer, even the overnight hours. So the inversions are weaker. So you're actually able to disperse a lot of that smoke throughout a bigger portion of the atmosphere. And that's why we typically don't see as high as levels. But certainly, if you do still see impacts from 2.5, you should probably stay indoors, especially during those 8 to 11 o'clock hour.
Boy, Matt, that's interesting, because obviously people want to be thoughtful about their health, certainly. But this is one of those rare times of year where everyone is sort of supposed to celebrate outside together. I mean, is there any sort of advice you'd give people when it comes to that, other than staying inside between 8 and 11? What if someone might have issues like that, but really wants to see the fireworks, really wants to hear the fireworks?
Certainly, if you want to go view the fireworks, it would be perfectly fine to do. You know, the smoke will move up fairly high and then disperse off whatever the direction's moving. And then just, you know, limit your exposure after that particular event that you're at. Maybe just, you know, go home after that particular time. But certainly we're not expecting it to reach the federal health standard. So we're not expecting any long-term impacts. But another thing people can do is also use a lot of caution when you are using these fireworks. Obviously, it's extremely dry out there. We have a lot of grass. And one of the big ways that fireworks could contribute to smoke here in the valley is if any wildfires do occur. And obviously, we can do our part to limit that by simply using our fireworks extremely carefully.
Typically, by the 4th of July, are we getting into that more humid pattern? Because we haven't yet. And how might that affect air quality? Let's say if this week we're going to be a monsoon kind of week.
So certainly, this is the time of year when we start looking for those dust storms to kick up, because certainly at the start of the season, we see the heat, and then that sets up the big monsoon pattern. Then we get the dust storms in, and then finally later in July, we start getting the rain. So the good news this July 4th is we're not expecting big dust storms moving in from the south like we can certainly see. But that is also going to mean that, especially coming in next week, if high pressure is still not set up, we could start again looking at some ozone issues before the pattern finally sets up and we get a lot more wind moving through the state. So we are closely watching when that monsoon pattern is going to set up as far as air quality is concerned.
And Matt, are you going to be out enjoying fireworks yourself?
I think so.
I hope so. Come on. Would you think so? Come on. Matt right. Pace is meteorologist for the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. Matt, thanks for the time today.
Thank you.
The fight over climate change has been one of the more intense public policy debates we're seeing on the national and international stages. Though a great majority of the public believes in climate change's existence, many elected officials, including President Trump, have refused to agree with that assessment. That, in turn, over the years has limited federal action on combating it. And so a group of 21 young people from across the country filed a lawsuit, Juliana versus United States, claiming they have the constitutional right to be protected from climate change and alleging the government has not followed through on that. Joy Herr Cardillo, an associate professor at the U of A's College of Law, is with me to talk about the case. Professor, to any extent, is this kind of suit unprecedented, at least as far as the way in which it's been presented?
it's definitely out of the ordinary, and it's a significant case and certainly an uphill battle. But historically, there have been similar cases in the past. In the oral argument on this case, the plaintiff's counsel frequently referred to Brown versus Board of Education. That's kind of a classic example of one of those seminal cases that really upended the law. So it's sort of on that scale. I mean, it's definitely not a typical run-of-the-mill case, but the judiciary has in the past played a major role on major issues.
If it were to proceed, is that something that one would think would take a number of cases, a long foundation to get there, because it would be so impactful if it were to go forward?
Something like this really, it reminds me of some of the types of cases that I litigated when I was a public interest lawyer, in that winning on the merits might not take all that much time, but where the challenge comes into play is in the implementation. Again, going back to Brown versus Board of Education, you get the substantive case, you know, definitive articulation of the rights, and then it takes multiple lawsuits, multiple court orders to actually implement the ruling of the court.
Let's get into what the plaintiffs would like to see occur. What changes would they like to see occur? Did the approach make sense? Was it possibility of overshooting, or does it seem to make sense, the approach they took?
That's really actually the great challenge of the case, because they are asking for very broad relief. And one of the questions that the Judge Hurwitz kept coming back to was, you know, say I want to rule in your favor, what does the order look like? What are you asking this court to do? And that's always dicey in cases like this, because essentially what you're asking is one branch of the government to direct other branches of the government to take action. Courts, by their nature, are really cautious. So they don't like to be accused of micromanaging either the legislative process or the executive branch. So that's, I think, one of the great challenges of this case. But what the plaintiffs articulated in the argument is, we've got a situation where not only is the government not really addressing the problem of climate change in a meaningful way, but they are pursuing and implementing policies with respect to fossil fuels that's making the situation much worse. They basically invoked this state harm exception to argue that the government had a duty to stop hurting future generations by promoting the use of fossil fuels. So that was kind of the maybe most specific relief that they requested. They were challenging the structural scheme of the government's energy and environmental policy. So it's a heavy lift.
So the argument is not that government passively allowed this to happen, but actually sort of actively took part by not. It's almost like there's an active and a passive argument there, where maybe they should have done something to stop it, and in lieu of stopping it, they actually passed legislation that made it worse?
They really did want to focus on, and I think part of this, I have never communicated with the plaintiff's counsel, so this is pure speculation on my part, but one of the concerns is, you know, can you compel the government to act? Does the government have an affirmative duty towards these plaintiffs? And that's always kind of hard to find in the Constitution, in maybe a common law doctrine like the public trust doctrine. I've personally made those arguments in the past in other contexts, but it's a challenge. So one way for them to kind of strengthen their position was to focus about the state-created danger that the actual energy policies and implementation of regulations that had favored the development of fossil fuels, that had allowed mining of fossil fuels or drilling for fossil fuels on public lands, how all of that contributed to global warming. So it's not like the federal government here is just a passive actor standing on the sidelines, not stepping in to protect the future generations. Rather, they're making the situation worse.
Is any of this about changing the argument in our communities, as opposed to just making the legal change? Is it important to sort of highlight this again in this sort of more unique way?
I think certainly the publicity that this lawsuit gets for the issue probably it helps. Yeah. I mean, you always run the risk of, you know, does it help? Does it hurt? How are people going to react to it? But just making people aware of the issue, and I think in this case, too, the having the plaintiffs be the younger generation, be young people who are really the most vulnerable on this issue and are most impacted, it makes good strategic sense.
Joy Herr-Cardillo is an associate professor at the U of A College of Law.
If you watch Netflix or listen to Pandora or buy stuff on Amazon, you're familiar with the concept of an algorithm picking other movies or music or soap it thinks you like based on what you originally picked. But now some companies are taking that a step farther. They're personalizing cosmetics or sports drinks or other products just for an individualized customer based on answers to a questionnaire or an analysis of someone's sweat. Our co-host Mark Brody spoke more about that with Steve Van Osselaar, a professor of marketing in the Johnson Graduate School of Management at Cornell University.
What is behind this, what seems to be sort of a newish trend of companies manufacturing and marketing products specifically, not just for a demographic, but for a specific person?
So one of the things that's behind it is that technology has made this possible. So it's become a lot easier now with computing power to find out what individual consumers' preferences are, and to build something that caters to their specific preferences or their specific body type or their specific needs. So the algorithms have gotten a lot better in terms of picking up what people need. The manufacturing has gotten a lot better in terms of being able to cheaply manufacture lots of different versions of things. And the logistics have gotten a lot better, which allows companies to send individual packages to individual homes very easily, right? We all get packages from Amazon and other vendors, and so that's really improved.
Do you see this in some ways as sort of an outgrowth of personalized medicine, where pharmaceutical companies can make specific medications based on a person's genetic makeup or DNA?
Right. I mean, I think that's another substantiation of exactly the same thing.
Is this something that customers really want?
I think they do for several reasons. So one of the things is that by customizing, you can really make something that fits an individual person. And so in some categories like cosmetics, that might really make a difference. And so consumers think, you know, this is going to be the perfect product for me. It perfectly fits me. The other thing is that in a lot of product categories now, you've got a lot of choice overload. I mean, if you look at cosmetics, there's often hundreds of options. And so it becomes very difficult to choose. Whereas what these approaches do is they measure, they ask you some questions or they measure something, and then they propose the perfect solution to you. You don't have to search among hundreds of options and figure out what is best for you. So that's a really big improvement. The other thing that happens is that our economy and our society can get pretty anonymous these days. So the nice thing that this does, especially when, for example, people ask you for your name and they put your name on the product, like at Starbucks, for example, that really has some positive effects as well, because we really like to feel treated as an individual person rather than just an anonymous provider of profit.
Hearing you describe, especially that second reason, really made me think of the reason that a lot of people turn to online dating. They see it as just a more efficient way to find a mate.
Right, right. And so this is a very efficient way to get the best cosmetics rather than the best mate.
Are there particular products that you think, or maybe even services, that you think this kind of personalization might be better suited for than others?
I think anything where you've got lots and lots of options, where the product is important to somebody, where they think that they have very specific needs that other people might not have, those would be the type of products where you'll see a lot of this. Also, when things get more central to who you are as a person, I think that's where you'd also benefit more from feeling like you're really being taken seriously and treated as an individual.
Are there privacy concerns associated with giving up some of this information? I mean, I would imagine like telling, you know, a company your skin tone might not be such a big deal, but are there certain products where maybe you have to give a little more information that maybe people will be slightly creeped out by?
Absolutely. Yes, there are lots of situations in which a lot of information is asked that you wouldn't want everybody to know. But even for things where you can actually not see that many rational ways in which you would think that there would be an abuse of privacy, we see that people are still worried about it. So, for example, we've done quite a few experiments where people are asked for their name, like you would at Starbucks when they ask you for your name to write on the cup. And even in those situations, I mean, it's not like telling them that your name is John is going to make them steal your identity. But even in those situations, people are worried about privacy. And so we see that for most people, they actually like it when they're asked for their name because they feel treated like an individual. For a subset of consumers, that is a negative because they're worried about privacy.
For the companies that are doing this, what is in it for them?
What's in it for them is that they basically get to charge a little bit more because people feel that they get a better product. And they also get more loyal customers. If as a company you take me seriously as a person, you make something that's specifically for me as a unique individual, I'm more likely to be quite satisfied with that product and become a more loyal customer.
So is there a sense, for example, that if I send in my sweat makeup to Gatorade and they develop a drink that really works for me, from then on, I'll just continue to order that as opposed to going to the grocery store and looking at what else might be out there?
Exactly. And also that reduces the cost because when you rebuy, they don't have to send you another patch for your sweat.
How big do you think this could get? I mean, do you think this could be the situation where more and more companies dealing with more and more products will be introducing this and it could ultimately make up some large percentage of our purchases?
I think it definitely can, but I think there's also an end to this. It's not going to be so big that we'll see it for all products. I personally am not interested in personalized milk or personalized salt.
That is Dean Van Osselaar, a professor of marketing in the Johnson Graduate School of Management at Cornell University, speaking with our co-host, Mark Brody. Okay, so Steve, you and I both wake up for work really early.
I don't want people to start the violins, Lauren, but yes, we're both incredibly sleep-deprived, yes.
Incredibly sleep-deprived. So this is potentially even worse for our health than we thought.
Even worse than the bags under my eyes? I don't believe you.
Well, yes, I understand that concern. So yes, new research from the University of Arizona researcher Caroline Doyle shows a clear link between sleepless nights and high blood pressure. And that could be the reason so many studies are showing that sleep problems increase the risk of heart attack, stroke, and even death from cardiovascular disease. But there is something we can do about it, Steve. I got a hold of Doyle for more.
So there's a ton of literature. It's this growing body of literature kind of sounding the alarm here that sleep is associated with cardiovascular outcomes. And this is, you know, there's paper after paper kind of saying this, but fewer papers are looking at the why. You know, what is connecting these two things? Why might sleep be related to cardiovascular disease, you know, stroke, heart attack, that sort of thing. So we thought, you know, blood pressure is one of the best predictors of cardiovascular disease. So we wanted to examine if there were any sort of day-to-day acute effects or a relationship between someone's objective sleep and their blood pressure.
How did you go about studying it? Give us the sort of groundwork.
Yeah, this was data from the study called the North Texas Heart Study. The methods of this study were pretty novel in some ways. So we basically strapped blood pressure cuffs on people for 2 days. We had them wear these little wrist these little watch devices called actigraphs that measure your activity and sleep. And we had them walk about their lives for 48 hours. And this alone is, that sampling method, I guess we would call it, is pretty novel in itself.
So was it super clear, this connection then, when you analyzed the data between those who did not have a good night's sleep and their blood pressure going up?
I would say that they were linked. They were definitely linked. So we found that shorter sleep and sleep that was more disturbed was linked to daytime and nighttime blood pressure. So that includes blood pressure the day after we measured sleep.
So what are the implications of this in terms of cardiovascular health then?
Mm-hmm. So this study, you know, I like to say it stands on the shoulders of giants. You know, there's a big literature out there, and this is just a snapshot, but it might indicate, you know, this is a connection to pay attention to, and there's something going on here. It's never bad advice to say, hey, sleep's important and it matters for your health. You can start, you know, by making sure the room is dark, getting the iPads and the phones out of the room at night, you know, these little things that can improve your sleep and make it less disturbed.
Right. So and this really underlies the fact that sleep is important. We know sleep is important. We know we don't feel good if we don't sleep. But you're mm-hmm. saying this is important in ways that can be exponential in terms of like your future well-being.
Potentially. We definitely need to do more research to really pin that down and see exactly what's going on here. But the fact that sleep is associated with these things that affect our life, things that cause death, you know, cardiovascular disease, mortality, it means that this is something to pay attention to. And there's a famous sleep researcher who said, you know, if sleep isn't the most important thing, it's the biggest mistake nature ever made. It's something like that. You know, we spend a third of our lives sleeping. That's a lot of time.
That's a lot of time. So you said you also just got back from a sleep conference. What's on the horizon here? This is a growing body of study, it sounds like.
Yes. And I get really excited about it. I'm fresh off the conference right now, surrounded by sleep researchers who are studying, you know, they're at the cellular level studying circadian biology, and they're next to doctors who are trying to help patients with sleep apnea and everything in between. And all these people are talking and trying to figure out what's going on with sleep, why is it important, and how can we help people? How can we reduce suffering that's caused from sleep?
That's Caroline Doyle. She's a PhD student at the University of Arizona in clinical health psychology. Caroline, thank you for joining us and giving us some much needed sleep advice.
Oh, thank you so much, Lauren.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.